Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, coming to you from attackthesystem.com. This is Monday morning, October the 28th, 2013. One of the big things that's been in the news lately is this issue of the government shutdown, about how the federal government supposedly was shut down over this dispute between the Democrats and the Republicans over Obamacare. And these are not really issues that I like to spend a lot of time on because I think it's a distraction from things that are more important. But a number of people have asked me, what do you think about this shutdown issue? And my obvious answer to that is there has been no government shutdown. With the Republicans did was attempt to shut off funding for features related to the implementation of Obamacare. If you are against Obamacare, I guess that's a good thing. If you're for it, I guess that's a bad thing. But the idea that the Republicans somehow caused the government to shut down is an absurdity. I'm certainly no fan of the Republicans. You know, I would say if only we could get so lucky to have a party, Democrat or Republican or something else, that would shut down the government for real, that would be excellent. But that's not exactly what's happened. All of this kind of thing is simply partisan maneuvering between the ruling parties. And nothing that we need to be particularly concerned about. So that's that, my brief two cents worth on the question of the government shutdown. Now, I also have a couple of new books out. Black House Publishing in England is issuing a couple of titles with yours truly as the author. And one of them is an anthology of works that I've published over the years at attackthesystem.com and elsewhere, and it's simply titled Attack the System, an Anthology, and then the subtitle is A New Anarchist Perspective for the 21st Century. I'm not sure if that book is available on Amazon yet. I know it's available through the publisher directly, and there is now a link to that book at Attack the System. If you go to Attack the System's homepage and scroll down, you'll see a link. That the book has an American flag on the cover with a gun and bullets on the top of it. Interesting graphic on the front. This book really is the definitive a definitive work, because it really defines what most of my thinking and what most of my work at Attack the System and elsewhere is really about. And this book is a collection of, I think it's 26 different essays, many of which have been previously published at Attack the System. And in this, I do outline a comprehensive theoretical foundation and strategic model for a 21st century anarchist movement. This is a set of ideas I've been working on for about a quarter of a century. Early in my career as an anarchist, I started noticing certain limitations, certain weaknesses in the wider anarchist milieu, lack of sense of direction, a lack of interest in strategic considerations, failure to reach out beyond its own narrow milieu, a lot of other issues. And what I've tried to do is, over the years, is create a foundation for a new anarchist movement that moves past the 19th century model of anarchism. It doesn't reject that or repudiate it, but it does move past it. It brings with it its own accomplishments, but it moves past that. And it also moves past this kind of 1960s model of radicalism that most contemporary anarchists hold to. and moves it into entirely new territory. So definitely check that book out if you have the opportunity. And there's another book I have out now about civil war in El Salvador. It was civil war in El Salvador during the 1980s. You had the government there, which was a puppet government of the American Empire, waging war against against the resistance led by the FMLN, and it got to be a pretty bloody struggle. And if you want to see what real revolutionary struggle looks like, definitely read this book. If you want to see what the American Empire really looks like up close and in person, definitely read this work. And I think this book is valuable for other reasons as well. So it's definitely something to check out. Both works are currently available at attackthesystem.com's homepage. Just scroll down, check on the image of the book, and you can order it from the publisher. Now, I came across a couple of articles this week that really drive home one of the basic points that I make here at Attack the System. One of them was an article in Reason Magazine about it was an article critiquing another article where a left-wing progressive writer was rejecting the idea that progressives should collaborate with libertarians in resistance to the surveillance state that was recently exposed by Edward Snowden and others, Glenn Greenwald, some other people. This progressive writer has come out and attacked the idea that progressives, people on the left of the political spectrum, should go out and align themselves with libertarians or conservatives or others who may also oppose the surveillance state. And the only real argument that this writer provides to justify this point of view is simply that libertarians generally oppose the welfare state. And I think this really does illustrate a point that I've made for many, many years, and that is that the left has become incapable of serving as an effective opposition force in the United States and in the Western world generally because of the fact that the left has become so mired in what can only be called a middle class, even upper middle class orientation. For some years ago, I remember having an argument with a leftist where I was criticizing what I was calling at the time bourgeois identity politics. And more and more and more what I see over time, my general argument, my general thesis about this continues to be confirmed repeatedly, and that is the progressive side of the political spectrum today is primarily a conservative force in society. It's conservative in that it wants to, first of all, protect the welfare state, and it's deadly afraid that somebody somewhere might try to cut out aspects of the welfare state, and they're even willing to overlook even bigger, even more serious issues like imperialism, like the police state, like the surveillance state, for the sake of protecting and defending the welfare state. And also the left today has become absorbed by a very narrow, very self-serving type of identity politics where it's all about getting a bigger piece of the system's pie for the groups that are generally favored by the left, like racial minorities, women, gays, and so forth. For instance, one of my co-editors at Attack the System, Miles Joyner, showed me an article this week about how this new head of the Homeland Security Department is an African American with a lengthy history of upholding police state repression. This is a fellow by the name of Johnson. And it's interesting because this fellow was a Democrat. He's an African American. He has staunch cultural progressive credentials. I think he was involved in trying to allow gays into the military and things like that. So this guy is certainly a cultural liberal by any means. At the same time, he's now head of one of the primary agencies of repression in the United States. And this is something that I have pointed out time and time and time again, is that in the future, what we will see is American society continuing to move leftward culturally. And we will see more and more people from the traditional outgroups, racial minorities, women, gays, and on and on, being incorporated into the system, even into the system's forces of repression. For example, nowadays, many, many cities have black police chiefs. Many, many cities have a large proportion of racial minorities on their police forces. You know, more and more we see women and other traditional outgroups assuming leadership roles in the prison industrial complex, in the legal system, and other institutions of repression. And this is something that I have argued for quite some time, that what the kind of system that's emerging is one where the empire, the ruling class, the state, the prison industrial complex, the police state, and so forth, all these kinds of things remain intact. And yet more and more, and yet demographically, these institutions are becoming more and more diverse, more and more inclusive. And that's really rather interesting to observe. But it does fit with the thesis that I have advanced for quite some time. And it's one of the reasons, in fact, it's the primary reason why I criticize the left, why I criticize the progressive side of the cultural spectrum to the degree that I do, because I've seen this thing coming for years. I've seen it coming for years where in the name of integrating more minorities into the system, more outgroups into the system, in the name of defending the welfare state and things like that, the left, the progressive side of the spectrum, has actually acquiesced to the wider system of oppression that's represented by the state, by the corporate class, by the military-industrial complex, by imperialism. The left has actually acquiesced to these things in order to advance some very narrow, very self-serving agendas, that is, enhancing the status of the more elite members of the traditional minority groups, defending what are basically middle-class entitlements through the welfare state. And in essence, the left has, because of this, become, or certainly the progressive left, has become a conservative force. And it's not just the mainstream left. It's not just the center-left, neoliberal, liberal Democrat left, the Obama Democrats. It's not just that either. Over and over and over again, in my discussions, in my debates, in my encounters with leftists, what I find is a very cautious conservatism. That is, I find a whole lot of people who are apprehensive about rocking the boat. And I think the reason for that is that they feel like the cultural left is winning, and they don't want to do anything that would destabilize the wider society because, well, that could create a backlash and the fascists could come back after 80 years and, you know, and who knows what would happen. What I find interesting about that is the way in which so-called progressives, so-called left-wingers, so-called many radicals, even many so-called anarchists have become so fearful, so cautious, in the sense that they have largely acquiesced to the system or incorporated themselves into the system, or even if they still stand in opposition to the system, they really don't want to take any kind of action that might actually attack the system. Because of this fearfulness that they have. So, of course, that's what we at Attack the System are about trying to move past. In the liberty and populism strategy that I outlined some years ago, one of the things that I talk about in that is the way in which in the future the liberals of today will be the conservatives of tomorrow. I wrote that article back in 2006, and in there I talk about how the liberals of the time would eventually be the conservatives. I talk about how someone with the views of Michael Moore will be a conservative at some point as the culture continues to move leftward. And And we're seeing that today. We're seeing that with an African American man, a staunch cultural leftist, who is becoming head of Homeland Security. We see this in the fact that those on the progressive side of the spectrum think defending the welfare state is more important than opposing the police state. This is what's happening. Now, last week I talked a little bit about this question of moving to the left of the left of the left. And, of course, in some past programs I've talked about the model of the political spectrum that people like Murray Rothbard have outlined, where they argue that liberals and socialists are really just a middle-of-the-road position. You've got the right, traditional conservatism, throne and altar, and all that kind of stuff, and then you've got the liberals who are to the left of that, and then you've got right-wing liberals, which would be our conservatives in the United States, and then left liberals, and then you've got the socialists and the Marxists. And then Murray Rothbard always argued, I think correctly, that anarchists and libertarians are to the left of that. And operating within that paradigm, I've been raising this question of what would the left of the left of the left actually look like. And to do that, I want to create a thought experiment where, let's say a few decades from now, we have a situation, a political situation in the United States where the conservative party, now irrespective of what the future fate of the Republican Party is, maybe the Republican Party will make a comeback at some point. Maybe it will continue as a permanent opposition party. Maybe it will fade away and be replaced by something else. Maybe the United States will essentially just be a one-party state in the future. Who knows? Right, but irrespective of arguments of that type, let's do a thought experiment where at some point in the future, we have a two-party system in the United States, and the conservative party, the party of the right, are basically comprised of Obama Democrats, people who have the same basic set of views as the Obama Democrats have today. And let's say that liberalism, the liberal party, is more like what the people who are to the left of the Obama Democrats would say. It's a mixture of the more leftist-leaning Democrats in Congress, the left wing of the Democratic Party, not the center left, not the neoliberals, not the Obama Democrats, but the left wing of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Socialists of America, the Greens, the SPUSA, the warmed over Marxist groups that are still around, the left wing anarchists, all of these groups that are grouped under the umbrella of the American left. Let's say that's liberalism, right? And I do think that that's the scenario we will have at some point in the future. We'll have a situation where the conservatism of the time is not any different from the Obama Democrats of today, and the liberalism of the time is no different than the radical left of today. And we see plenty of precedents from that from the past. For example, it can be argued, I think quite convincingly, that Ronald Reagan, even though he was a Republican, he had a conservative image and so forth, did not govern any further to the right than John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy, prototypical liberal Democrat, had very similar actual policies to those of Ronald Reagan. George W. Bush, who became something of a boogeyman for the left during his time, did not govern any further to the right than, say, Lyndon Johnson. They both pursued very similar policies, a foolish imperialist war, radical expansion of immigration, record budget deficits, lots of other expansion of the welfare state, very similar in both ways. Plus, they were both from Texas. So the lesson of that is that over time, what constitutes conservatism in the United States tends to constantly shift leftward. Now, the paleoconservatives, for example, scholars like Dr. Paul Gottfried have pointed this out in great detail, where yesterday's conservatism tends to be removed further and further removed from the system, and the conservatism of any given era tends to be yesterday's liberalism. And a good example of that, for example, is the way that now the conservative Republicans, the mainstream conservatives, try to claim someone like Martin Luther King as a conservative icon. And in reality, in the 1960s, when Martin Luther King was still alive, all of the conservative publications back then were denouncing him as a communist and a subversive. So we see how radically to the left so-called conservatism has shifted in the last few decades, and that will continue. I would predict that at some point in the not-too-distant future, the conservatives of today, the mainstream Republican Party-oriented conservatives of today, will be in a similar position that the paleoconservatives are in at present, where at present the paleoconservatives are essentially an out-group. They are a group that is now so far to the right that they're outside the realm of respectable opinion. And the Republican Party, the conservative establishment, wants absolutely nothing to do with them. And I think that the mainstream conservatives will eventually suffer a similar fate, in that someone who has the same views as a Fox News Republican today will eventually become as socially unacceptable as a paleoconservative is at present. And conservatism in the future, whatever it will be called, whatever its party affiliation will be, those are somewhat separate questions. But the right wing of the establishment in the future will be something not dissimilar to the Obama Democrats of today, the neoliberals, the center left. And during that time, the left of today, the radical left of today, will simply be mainstream liberalism. And in fact, that's the way it is, already is in many ways. I've said before that if you sit in on a meeting of a leftist group today, of a supposed radical leftist group, you often think that you're sitting in on a precinct meeting of the Democratic Party, because the ideas are basically no different. They're essentially talking about the same kinds of issues, the same kinds of topics, the same kinds of agendas. And it does seem, you know, I've always criticized the left anarchist, the mainstream anarchist movement, for example, as just the youth culture wing of the Democratic Party. And that's definitely the image they convey. So in the future, we will have a situation where today's liberals are the conservatives, today's radical left are the liberals. Now, the question is, what would be to the left of that? That's the question I've been examining over the past couple of programs. What would be to the left of that? What would be more radical than the radical left as it is today? And that is much of what we do at AttackTheSystem.com. Much of what we do here has to do with dealing with that question, is what will be the next wave of radicalism? Now, once the so-called radical left of today becomes fully integrated into the system and it's just a loyal liberal opposition, which it more or less is anyway, but once that is fully consolidated, once that situation becomes ever more explicit, what would be more radical than the radical left of the time, of our present time? That is largely the question that I have explored in much of my work over the years. That is, looking to the future and thinking about what is the future of radicalism once today's ineffective radicalism has passed on into the system. Now, this is a question where a lot of people seem to get very confused, and I've noticed that my own work in this area is frequently misinterpreted. So I want to go back over some of this stuff a little bit. If we see the future of American politics as something where liberalism of today is going to be the future of conservatism, the radical left of today is going to be the future of liberalism, and those two forces collectively will be the establishment, and we're trying to attack that establishment, then how do we go about doing that? What is the new radicalism? And virtually everything I've written over the years has been oriented towards that, has been very future-oriented towards the purpose of building this new radicalism. And I outlined some basic characteristics that this new radicalism would likely assume. One is that it would take a much more consistently critical position regarding the state. Not only because ideologies like anarchism and libertarianism would likely have a very strong influence on the new radicalism, but also because the state system itself is breaking down on a worldwide basis. And one of the insights of fourth generation warfare is that traditional states are in a position of decline and that non-state actors, non-state forces are rising. So due to the many different trends in the world that are contributing that, due to the nature of ideological evolution in the wider culture, we can predict that the next wave of radicalism will have a very strong anti-state bent to it. Parallel to that, I think the next wave of radicalism will also be very class-oriented. In fact, probably one of its most defining characteristics would be its class basis, because as class divisions continue to widen in the U.S., we will start to see more and more economic unrest, and we'll start to see more and more movements evolve that seek to challenge the plutocracy, that seek to challenge the corporate ruling class. And I think that'll take on a lot of different forms. Somebody asked me about that recently. Well, when the class divisions widen, there's bound to be some kind of rebellion. What kind of forms will it take? And it'll probably take a lot of different forms and have lots of different ideologies. Everything from social democracy to left-wing anarchism to anti-corporate libertarianism to economic nationalism to populism, many different kinds of philosophies will probably emerge that seek to challenge corporate power, that seek to challenge plutocratic power, that seek to challenge class power. So the next wave of radicalism will have a strong economic component to it and have as its class base those classes that are on the bottom layers of society as class divisions widen. That doesn't mean there won't be anybody from the middle class, there won't be anybody from the affluent or wealthy classes, not at all. But I do think that it will have a strong class orientation towards the lower end. Now, another aspect of the next wave of radicalism that I think I see emerging is opposition to the police state. I mentioned in a recent broadcast that the police state is now so out of control that police state repression is starting to fall over into the middle class, into the affluent classes. At the same time, it's also interesting to see how things like the prison industrial complex have reached a tipping point, because the prison industrial complex is starting to become cost prohibitive due to the fiscal problems that the United States has. And we also see that the war on drugs seems to have reached a tipping point. And due to generational change, I think, as much as anything else, public opinion on the war on drugs is starting to shift a little bit and become a little bit more liberalized. So I think that these things will all gain momentum over time. And at some point in the future, we're going to see a movement emerge for serious resistance to the police state as more and more people become victimized by the police state, as more and more people become aware of this issue. I do think we'll see more and more resistance emerge. We saw that in the late 60s, where you had groups like the Black Panthers that were trying to organize resistance to the police state as it was in black communities at the time. In the 1990s, we saw the rise of the militia movement for the purpose of organizing resistance to federal police state repression of the kind that happened at Waco and at Ruby Ridge. And I think we'll continue to see that in the future, particularly as more and more things like more and more there's a greater exposure of the surveillance state as police state repression becomes more intense. As liberalization of things like drug policy and criminal justice policy begins after a lengthy period of repression. So the next wave of radicalism will definitely have a strong anti-police state, probably strongly libertarian orientation in legal and cultural and social matters. And that gets us to another question, and that is the future of radicalism will also be something that I think on one hand is culturally pluralistic. You know, it won't be cultural conservatism per se, but it will be culturally pluralistic in the sense that, yeah, it will embrace pluralism and diversity and all these kinds of things. But it will also be something that moves away from this kind of political correctness that we've seen emerge in the last couple of decades. And I think, once again, the thing that will be most effective is generational change. As more and more younger people come along who were not products of the older culture that political correctness emerged out of, I think more and more people will start to challenge some of the more absurd ideas that we see associated with PC, as well as some of the more repressive state policies. For instance, I've heard younger people who are in bands and into music and stuff like that talk about how, well, nowadays there's no place for bands to play because, you know, nobody can smoke in a club, so nobody wants to go to a club anymore. You know, nobody can go to a club and drink without being harassed by the cops and that kind of stuff. So I think the kind of therapeutic state, nanny state repression that we see emerging now will eventually generate a backlash, and that will cause more and more people to embrace more libertarian values. And over time, I also think that the wider society will, I mean, in fact, I don't think it, I think I'm sure of it, the wider society will also become more diversified, and we'll see an ever greater, wider variety of cultural groups emerging. We'll also see more and more forms of identity politics developing. And that, of course, is one of the most controversial aspects of my own thinking. For one reason or another, of anything inflammatory that I've ever said or written, the thing that seems to set some people off the most is when I talk about how a natural constituency or a set of allies for a future radical movement would be certain movements or tendencies or demographics or whatever that are normally associated with the right. But I have very good reasons for making those arguments, and the argument is, as society changes, as power relations change in the wider society, many groups that were once considered part of the mainstream culture or even part of the dominant culture will start to become outgroups. And we see that even today as well. We see that on one hand, it's no longer socially acceptable to ridicule racial and ethnic minorities on one hand, but it's not quite as socially unacceptable to ridicule poor, uneducated white folks, or it's not as socially acceptable, or it's not as socially unacceptable to ridicule people from the South as backward or uneducated, or it's not as socially unacceptable to ridicule traditional religious believers unless they belong to some sort of group that's considered a traditional minority, like, say, Muslims or something like that. And I think that kind of thinking will intensify, and it will also create a backlash. You know, one of the hallmarks of radicalism is that radicalism tends to orient itself towards those who are on the margins of society and on the bottom layers of society. And, of course, that's why the left today tends to be so oriented towards more traditional outgroups. But as the dynamics of what constitutes an out-group continues to change, we will start to see more and more people who were once part of the dominant culture or certainly the mainstream culture becoming more and more marginalized, becoming more and more relegated to lower caste status. And those in turn will become natural constituencies and natural allies for the next wave of radicalism, given that radicalism is often or much of the time about defending traditional outgroups from attacks by the establishment. I also think that there's a lot of other types of political and cultural interests that we've only begun to see emerge demand a political voice for themselves. So the next wave of radicalism is going to be much different from the political left as constituted today. It'll be different from the right, but it will be much different from the political left. I think it will have a much more, much stronger anti-state orientation, certainly a class-based orientation, certainly very culturally diverse and pluralistic, but much more skeptical of political correctness than to the present wave of radicals. And I think it'll also be very oriented towards challenging the police state and all the institutions that are a part of the police state. I think that will be a very serious issue that emerges at some point in the future, just like another serious issue was going to be class relations and the ever-widening class divisions. Now, in the book that I wrote on El Salvador, what I talk about in that is how what I'm generally describing is the fact is how the lower classes in El Salvador had been subject to fairly brutal repression and certainly very severe economic hardship and exploitation for a number of years, and for decades, for generations, and every effort at peaceful reform was thwarted, and eventually it developed into a full blown armed struggle. Repression escalated in response, and you had a full blown civil war. And probably the greatest danger that I see in the future of American society is that a repeat of what happened in El Salvador could actually happen in North America. And what I mean by that is, as class divisions widen, there will certainly be a lot more poverty and a lot more people driven to political radicalism. On the basis of self-interest and on the basis of the way things are going socially. As more and more people are being driven to radicalism, the state will likely respond with repression. And what's interesting about that is that even though I think the American empire is certainly receding and losing its legitimacy and its ability to fight foreign imperialist wars, will continue to diminish over time due to fiscal reasons, due to loss of legitimacy and things like that. It's also true that the military-industrial complex that the state has at its disposal is not going to go away anytime soon. And even though it seems like the prison-industrial complex has reached a certain tipping point, the drug war has reached a certain tipping point, the police state apparatus that has emerged from those things. Now, the growth of the contemporary police state in the United States goes all the way back to the late 60s and early 70s. It goes back to COINTELPRO. It goes back into creation of SWAT teams and paramilitary policing. It goes back to the beginnings of the modern war on drugs. The war on drugs was escalated in the 1980s. That was expanded to a general war on crime and gangs and guns, and then in the 2000s on terrorism. And out of that, this massive police state, massive surveillance state, this paramilitary police occupation has developed. And I don't see that going away anytime soon either. So in the generations ahead, in the decades ahead, as class divisions widen, as social unrest escalates, as radical movements of different kinds emerge, the system is going to be increasingly inclined to use that police state, to use that military-industrial complex that they have at their disposal against their own population, against the domestic population of the United States, as a means of maintaining control and repressing unrest. That is really the main danger that our society faces in the future. You know, our society does not face a danger from communist Muslims, like the people out there who were saying that Obama is a communist Muslim and things like that. No, Obama is a tool of the international bankers, of the corporate plutocracy, and all of the institutions that have traditionally controlled the American government. The danger is not from fascists and neo-Nazis. To read the literature of the radical left, you'd think fascists and Nazis are hiding around every corner, behind every tree, behind every building, looking to create some kind of Fourth Reich any minute now. That's not the case either. These traditional forms of totalitarianism are not at present and are not likely to be anytime in the foreseeable future a threat to society as it is in North America at present. The danger comes from this widening class divisions that we see going on, this police state that the system has at its disposal, the military-industrial complex. It is the system that poses the greatest danger. Now, I do think resistance to all of this will grow over time. In the decades ahead, a new radicalism will emerge. It'll probably take on a lot of different forms, and we will see the system moving against the new wave of radicalism as a means of maintaining its own position. And what I'm about politically is preparing for the day when this comes. I'm often asked about all the different kinds of political groups I associate with. You know, some that by conventional standards are rather bizarre, some that are by conventional standards rather taboo, some that are have a lot of unusual ideas. And at the same time, I also associate with people who have very mainstream, middle-of-the-road views about a lot of things as well. But what I'm about is trying to build a comprehensive resistance. I'm trying to build, first and foremost, a leadership group, that is, a network of people who understand these issues and who understand what is coming, what the future of our society is likely to be, and the need to be prepared for the struggle ahead. Unfortunately, I don't see a whole lot of radicals out there who are doing that. Like I said, most so-called radicals have just become good liberals. They're just good progressives. And the progressives are now the conservatives. That's really the situation we're in. So I've tried to take a look at some of these issues, some of these problems that are appearing on the horizon, and try to develop a plan of action for how to go about dealing with some of this kind of stuff. And I'm interested in developing a leadership network of people from all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of movements, all kinds of cultures, whatever, who understand these issues and understand the need for taking action to deal with some of these kinds of issues. And I'm also interested in not only building a leadership group, but ultimately building a large enough movement or collection of movements that it can be an effective resistance, and it can be a resistance that not simply resists, but actually has a comprehensive, drawn-out set of ideas about what to do as an alternative to the system. Now, one of the problems with the kind of radicalism that you saw in the 60s was that most of the people in those movements had very little idea of what kind of society they were trying to develop or what their future goals were. It was more of an anti-movement. And what I mean is they were anti-Vietnam War, they were anti-segregation in the South, things like that. And that I think has been one of an enduring legacy among the left politically, and that's become a crisis issue for the left today, and that the left today is really unable to articulate any kind of alternative vision. Instead, the left is more just an anti-movement. It's a reaction to things that it doesn't like. So I've tried to move past all of that, and what I have tried to do is outline an agenda for a program that is about building a leadership core, is about developing a network of leaders, is about trying to create something that can ultimately become a political majority, so that when the current system breaks down, we do have something in place that can replace the current system in a way that is constructive. Quite often when systems break down, when societies fail, what you get are things like civil war, you get the rise of a regime that's even worse than what came before, and that is what we should be trying to avoid. What we should be trying to do is work out a constructive plan that considers everyone's interests and is working towards forging a very basic consensus about what the alternative will be when the system finally runs its course. And most of what I have written about over the years deals with these kinds of issues. George Kennan, who was a leading diplomat in the United States in the 20th century, he's probably most well known for being one of the early architects of the Cold War, at least Cold War policy as it was in its early phases, before it became excessively militarized. But George Kennan, towards the end of his life, and he was very much an establishment figure. I mean, this guy came from upper class, northeastern, old money. He was a part of the State Department under various presidents for years. I mean, this guy was not a radical, not an anti-establishment person at all. He was about as establishment as it gets. But towards the end of his life, probably when he was in his 80s or 90s, he came to realize that just as decades earlier he had said that the Soviet Union would eventually fall under its own weight. He said that at the beginning of the Cold War. He said the Soviet Union would fall under its own weight. He came to believe that just as the Soviet Union did in fact run its course and expire because it was a system that wasn't able to sustain itself, so would the United States go in a similar direction. And George Kennan, by the 1980s, 1990s, was advocating for dissolving the United States into smaller constituent republics, as he called them, that were institutions more on a human scale, where power was less concentrated and more manageable. And again, most of my own work is about taking this idea and pursuing it to its logical conclusion. Now, what I'm about is doing what is necessary to develop a movement that can eventually replace the United States of America. All right, and this is an issue that transcends left, transcends right, transcends the middle. This is not a radicals versus moderates issue. This is not a left versus right issue. This is not a reform versus revolution issue. Those are all somewhat separate questions, and what I'm talking about is quite often a much bigger question than any of that. All right? I'm about developing a leadership core of people from all kinds of backgrounds who understand that the system is doomed, and we need to start preparing ourselves for a post-United States. What will be going on in the North American continent when the Soviet when the United States disappears like the Soviet Union? And we need to be organizing towards that end, towards eventually dismantling the system in a way that is as well organized as possible, as constructive as possible, as peaceful as possible, while recognizing that it may not be completely peaceful, trying to certainly keep violence and things like that to a minimum. But that is the kind of thing that we need to be talking about. And all of the kinds of alternative institutions that I have discussed or advocated for, or ideas of that type that I've thrown out for discussion, are about this. They're about trying to create some sort of plan, some sort of movement, some sort of strategy, some sort of agenda for what the post-United States, what post-American America will actually be. And when it comes to the question of trying to reach a political majority, you know, I've said before, my purpose is to promote all anarchist, all libertarian, all decentralist movements, all dissident movements generally, until they become a majority, as well as this broader strategic concept like pan-secessionism and other similar ideas, or related ideas. What I'm about with all that is trying to create an eventual political majority where the consensus is towards dissolving the system and having institutions, counter-institutions or alternative institutions that can accommodate everyone's interests up to a point. And I've developed a fairly large audience for these ideas. When I look over my my mail, my Facebook messages, my emails, my questions I get from listeners of this program or readers of AttackTheSystem.com, I see that I seem to have a very diverse group of people who follow what I do. There are liberals, there are conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, leftists, rightists, anarchists, libertarians, Marxists, fascists, Muslims, Christians, people who are into conspiracy theories, people who are into alternative medicine, people from a lot of different kinds of backgrounds and beliefs and cultures tend to follow what I do, and I seem to have a rather unique audience. And I think that the reason for that is because I am one of the few people out there that's addressing some of these bigger questions. Very little of what I talk about deals with ordinary partisan issues, rivalries between Democrats and Republicans. I could care less about any of that. All of the arcane economic ideologies that many different kinds of radicals hold to. While I think stuff like that is interesting, I'm more interested in the bigger picture. All of the so-called culture war issues that people like to fight about. I'm about rising above that as much as possible as well. And I'm about trying to develop a consensus for what the new system will be once the current system has run its course. And that's why I promote the idea, works of people like Thomas Naylor, founder of the Second Vermont Republic. That's why I talk about concepts like pan-secessionism. That's why I try to inform people about Norman Mailer's 1969 campaign for mayor of New York, where he wanted to make New York City into the 51st state and then dissolve the city government of New York into a federation of neighborhoods. These are the prototypes for the new system once the current system has run its course. A lot of my critics don't like the fact that within my circle of associates, within my audience and so forth, there are people with ethno-nationalist or racist or racialist or ethnocentric views. And that's why I try to point out examples of things like ethno-states that are peaceable, functional societies. You know, you could argue that Iceland is a peaceful, functional white ethno-state, or Japan is a peaceful, functional Asian ethno-state, or Botswana is a peaceful, functional African ethno-state. Those are prototypes for future institutions, future political arrangements that might help get across get past some of this these ethnic and racial divisions that we have in our own society. And I'm also interested in alternative economic ideas from all across the spectrum. I've one article that I did frequently for years is a piece that Larry Gambone, a left anarchist, did a few years ago, where he was talking about all the different kinds of ideas that were found in the classical socialist movement and how those kinds of ideas have largely been lost over time. and trying to revive some of these ideas, or at least throw them out for discussion. I've promoted the work of Kevin Carson, who is an alternative economist with some very interesting ideas. Carson has outlined what I think really should be some of the primary economic issues for a future radical movement. He's got a work that he did some years ago called The Political Program for Anarchists, where he talks about how to go about simultaneously attacking Big Brother government and the corporate plutocracy. These kinds of things will be the basis of the new radicalism. And it's unfortunate that the left has been so co-opted by the system in the name of very narrow, self-serving forms of identity politics, in the name of being bought off by the welfare state. The left has largely been co-opted by the system, while the right, the radical right, is losing power and shrinking demographically. To the point where it's no longer able to be an effective resistance as well. It's also true that the radical right, by representing communities, cultures, religions, ethnic groups, and so forth, that are becoming outgroups, that in turn makes them a natural set of constituents and allies for a future radical movement. And I've written also about many different issues that we can incorporate into our own movement that are ignored by the mainstream society. One of my favorite books is a book that was written about 20 years ago by a fellow named Peter McWilliams. Peter McWilliams was a kind of a conventional liberal libertarian writer who wrote a book back in the early 90s called Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do. And he was attacking the concept of what libertarians call victimless crimes or consensual crimes, and talking about how these kinds of things really were becoming the basis for the dramatic expansion of the prison population in the United States, how they really were creating a far-reaching police state. And, of course, he was writing this 20 years ago, and everything that he was talking about has in that book has exploded. All of those things have increased exponentially since that time. And that's something that neither side of the political spectrum, the right or the left, has really taken up as one of its issues, and that is repealing laws that creates consensual crimes, things where there is no identifiable victim. There are at any one time hundreds of thousands of people in jail or prison over these kinds of things, and no constituency, not the left or the right, no mainstream faction has really adopted this as one of its primary issues, other than libertarians. So that is another issue that the new radicalism can incorporate into its own paradigm. Now, another big thing that I think will really divide the true radicals from the do-gooders, the reformers, the progressives who've become a new establishment in the future, is this question of so-called humanitarian war. Now, humanitarian war on its face sounds like an oxymoron, and it is. But there are some people out there who advocate such a thing, and that's why I talk about it. More and more, I think the American empire will be unable to fight imperialist wars due to fiscal constraints and lack of public interest. But it's also true in the future that the empire will try to justify its own imperialist aggression by claiming to be fighting for humanitarian values. And they've done that in the past. They claimed they were fighting in Vietnam to keep the South Vietnamese free from the commies, and they claimed they were fighting in Iraq to oppose a dictator and bring democracy to the Middle East and that kind of stuff. And more recently, they were threatening an invasion of Syria in the name of human rights and things like that. And we'll continue to see that kind of thing happening. And we should never be taken in by any of that, because what the system is trying to do with those kinds of things is appeal to the natural humanitarian instincts of many people. You know, they're trying to say, well, isn't it awful that these people over here, this regime, this nation, the state, does not respect human rights or does these terrible things? And shouldn't we go over here and try to help people out who are being oppressed? And of course, many people find that to be convincing rhetoric, and that in turn plays into the system's hands, and the system is able to go and engage in acts of aggression and use these kinds of concerns as a cover. And that's something we should always be prepared to expose. Antiwar.com. Antiwar.com is a fantastic resource because that they, as much as any other news source out there, in print or online, really on a day-to-day basis, cuts to shreds the rhetoric of the imperialist. And it shows how each successive event, each successive thing that the each successive acts of aggression that the imperialists attempt to engage in, essentially is a smokescreen for some ulterior motive. So if you don't read read antiwar.com, I'd highly suggest that you do so. It's a fantastic resource. But we do see the foundation for this new radicalism to emerge at some point in the future. That is, a radicalism that's not this Obama progressive whatever it is, and it's not the present-day radical left either that's so easily co-opted over identity politics, over social issues, over defense of the welfare state. But we see the foundation emerging for a genuine radicalism, something that really is about overthrowing the imperialists, something that really is about overthrowing the police state, overthrowing the plutocracy, that recognizes the value of cultural pluralism and diversity, but fails to fall into the trap of an authoritarian progressivism, political correctness, and all that kind of stuff. That a new radicalism that really does uphold individual rights, individual freedoms across the board through things like opposing consensual crime laws in the way that the libertarians are really the only group that does now. These are all things that we can incorporate into this new radicalism. If there's a whole lot of constituencies and potential allies out there that we can cultivate as partners in this revolutionary struggle. There are a lot of ideas in circulation about what an alternative to the current system might be. And ultimately, we need to develop a leadership group that is capable of pulling all these forces together and then making this into a mass movement that eventually becomes a political majority. And the thing is, because the goal of a movement of this type is decentralization, of dissolving the system and creating alternative institutions, micronations, city-states, sovereign communities, and so forth, it's not necessary that everyone agree about everything. The kind of resistance movement I envision would, yes, it would have to be a political majority eventually, but it could also be a coalition of coalitions, and that is its general theme, its general orientation in certain geographical areas or certain institutional contexts might vary widely. You know, I've mentioned how the kind of resistance movement I've mentioned might take on a different form in the inner cities than it would in the rural areas, and it might take on a still different form in suburban areas. And it might take on one form in the south and one form in the north and one in the west and so forth. But ultimately, it's about pulling all of these kinds of forces together. You know, like I said, many different kinds of people listen to this program. Many different kinds of people read the work that I do. You know, peace activists, military veterans, black nationalists, white nationalists, liberals, conservatives, people who are pro-life, people who are anti-life, who are pro-choice, people who are pro and anti-immigration, people who are evangelical Christians, people who are atheists, Muslims. There's a wide spectrum of readers that we have at Attack the System. There's a wide spectrum of listeners that we have at Attack the System, and that in turn is the foundation for this new radical movement that's going to emerge at some point in the future. Something that is more radical than any of the opposition movements at this point. Something that is in many ways to the left of the left of the left. It's not neoliberalism. It's not the present day radical left. It's more radical than that. At the same time, it blends with, you know, if you go far enough left, the political spectrum is a circle, not a straight line. So if you go far enough left, you end up connecting with the right. And that's what we've done in Attack the System. We've identified many different constituents, many different social forces on the right that are now outgroups, that are now under attack by the system, which means they are natural allies or natural constituents of a new radicalism. And we're continuing to develop these ideas much further. So that's a little something to think about. And until next time, this has been Keith Preston for Attack the System. Please check out the new books that I have out. Attack the System, an anthology, a new anarchist perspective for the 21st century, and my book on the Civil War in El Salvador in the 80s as well. Both of those are available on the homepage of Attack the System. There are images. You can just click those on. It'll take you right to the publisher, and you can pick up a copy of those books. So that's definitely worth doing. And until then, this is Keith Preston. Have a good week.